Disclaimer. This episode of A Dark Cup of Histity does include some descriptions of graphic violence, murder and sexual assault. Probably not advisable for listeners under 13, so listener discretion is advised. I would also make an apology in advance for any papers you hear rustling, because some of the things I will be reading from paper, and also if you hear any sipping, I am sipping from a carton of white chocolate flavoured milk that Tobias Nichols from the Manic Podcast, two N's, very important, has unknowingly but kindly donated. Thanks, Tobias. Anyway, gotta be serious now.
Yeah. This week on A Dark Cup of Histity, we make a start on a series of darker episodes embracing the spooky autumn chill in the lead up to the most historic holidays still celebrated in Western culture, Halloween. Our first foray into the dark and disturbing takes us back to 19th century London and a mystery that still intrigues over a century on, and where the greatest evil was a human one. And in our ridiculous death, we look at why you should probably watch
that meteor shower from undercover. So settle in, grab yourself a tot of gin and your best bonnet.
And let's get dark.
First, let's give you some background to the scene. As London back then is something somewhat different to the London that we know now. Many of the place names are the same, but it's more the culture there that we need to elaborate on.
Yeah, London has been a city for thousands of years, since the Romans walled and fortified the small settlement along the River Thames and called it
Londinium.
I prefer that.
Yeah, it just sounds better.
It does. She has thrived and grown as a shining beacon of culture, art, civilization, history and education. But where there is light, there is also darkness.
London in the late 1800s was very much a thriving industrial city, with the haves and have-nots firmly in their places. In the West End of London, at Westminster, were the richer citizens, your politicians, wealthy merchants and businessmen, nobles and the royals. Victoria was coming towards the end of her record-breaking 64-year reign, still deeply mourning for her long-since-dead husband Albert. We'll cover them at a later date. Whilst it had its fair share of drama, of course, the West End of London was pretty well off.
The East End, however, was the opposite end of the scale. People pounded the streets in the early hours looking for work. Pubs sold gin by the pint. I mean, okay. Doss houses offered the only real accommodation, with a room for 4 pence a night, and workhouses were there for those who couldn't even afford that.
I will just say, like, you got excited about the gin for a pint. This was a proper brewed in the bathtub, stripped the paint off the bath gin. How people survived, I do not know. Crimes such as theft, assault, and even rape were common. Even murder was not unknown. And the people that worked there worked in any way they could, and they scraped a meagre living doing whatever work was available that would help them to keep a roof over their heads.
For men, there were the options to work at the docks on ships, or bring in the catch in, or they could work as like a butcher, meaning there would be frequent sightings of men walking home in bloody clothes.
Yeah, you kind of became desensitised to that sort of thing. For women, those that weren't lucky enough to work in service would do smaller jobs in the local area, be washerwomen or sell something that they had any measure of control over, their bodies. It wasn't uncommon to see unfortunate or fallen women working the streets. By 1888, it's estimated that there were around 5,678 prostitutes known to police within London. That's just the ones known, not the ones that they didn't know about or that they didn't record.
Yeah. Unfortunately, sex crimes were also common, as was drunk and disorderly behaviour. So there was no shock in finding women of all ages slumped in doorways, having spent their DOS money on gin rather than accommodation, sleeping it off before going on to try and make more money to hopefully get a bed the next night. It's recorded that the youngest known prostitute was as little as 6 years old. But if the alternative was the workhouse, what does that tell you about the conditions of the workhouses?
Exactly. The police force back then was pretty similar to the format that we know now, though for those not used to London or the odd way we British like to complicate things sometimes, here's a little word to the wise. The police force in the UK is split into regions, so we here have the Norfolk Police near us, and then that feeds into the Cambridgeshire Police when you get to, well, Cambridgeshire.
Yep.
London is a pretty big place though, understatement. So there are two distinct police forces that you need to know about. There's the City of London Police and the Metropolitan Police. The City of London Police covered central London, so that's everything that used to come inside the old Roman wall. The Metropolitan Police would then have jurisdiction pretty much everywhere else, so that's wherever London then spread out into her metropolitan boroughs, settlements which surround a core city or metropolis, from the Greek meta, meaning mother, and polis, meaning city. Mother City, London, and her metropolitan boroughs.
I like that.
Yeah. So, City of London is the old Roman part, Metropolitan in the other bits. It's only important to note as the boundary line was crossed at one point, but they then both got involved.
Right. So now that we have some background, join us as we go back in time. Wrap your cloaks tight around you, ladies and gentlemen, as we walk the streets of Whitechapel District in the east of London, 1888, where one unfortunate resident is about to make a grisly discovery that will set off a chain of events that forever changed the city.
Before we continue with our episode, just a quick aside. There are a number of other possible victims of the figure that history recalls as Jack the Ripper. However, some of those have never been fully linked for various reasons, like lack of evidence and bungled investigations probably being the main ones. So we're going to be focusing on what is known as the canonical five, the five victims associated with the notorious serial killer that stalked the streets of Whitechapel, as well as one who is unofficially recognised but still disputed as possibly being the first victim. So she's kind of not quite canonical, but not quite not.
Yeah.
However, we will mention the other women briefly at the end because, honestly, nobody should be forgotten.
No. On the 7th of August, 1888, it was a Tuesday. The day before had been Bank Holiday Monday, with many out and about enjoying the day as much as they possibly could, despite the characteristically British weather. One such couple was Joseph and Elizabeth Mahoney, who both lived at number 47 George Yard Buildings in the London's East End. After their full day, they returned home at around 1:40 a.m. on the 7th of August. Elizabeth Mahoney quickly nipped out to get something for supper at a shop at nearby Thrall Street. Her shopping trip took about 10 minutes, and so she returned a little before 2 a.m. The couple had their supper and went to bed. Nothing out of the ordinary was seen or noticed, and they slept undisturbed.
Also living in George Yard Buildings, at number 35, was licensed cab driver, like the horse and carriage kind, Alfred Crowe. He'd had a busy night of it, so he returned home ready for bed at 3:30 a.m. on the 7th of August. He was used to driving around in the dark, so whilst he wasn't carrying a candle, he could still see pretty well. Alfred made out the shape of a figure lying on the first floor landing, but that was not an odd thing. Often people who couldn't afford the Doss House money for that night would be found sleeping rough on landings and in hallways for shelter from the elements. So Alfred ignored the figure and he carried on to his room, where he, too, slept undisturbed.
Then his neighbour at number 37, John Reeves, he didn't ignore that figure, however. He was heading out for work at 4:45 a.m. after an early and undisturbed night of sleep. The sun was beginning to rise by this point and he could see a little bit more clearly. When Reeves reached the first floor landing, he came across this same figure, and he was able to make out that it was a woman, and that she was lying in a pool of blood. After a few moments to register the shock and horror of what he was seeing, Reeves made his way downstairs and out onto the street to find a policeman.
When Reeves returned to the body, he was accompanied by PC Thomas Barrett. PC Barrett took some note of some of the basic details that would later be revisited in the inquest. The victim was middle-aged, female, plump, approximately 5'3" in height. She was lying on her back with her hands by her side and her legs spread open with her skirts lifted up to her abdomen. Barrett's mind automatically went to sexual assault, and though it was clear the woman was dead, he still had to send for a doctor to make the official pronouncement, much as they have to do now.
Yeah. Dr. Timothy
Colleen.
I thought I was going to have to cough. I apologise.
That's all right, sorry.
Dr. Timothy Colleen of 68 Brick Lane was the attending physician and he arrived at the scene at approximately 5:30 a.m. in the morning. He was only able to do a quick examination in the low light and limited space, but he could establish that the victim had been stabbed no fewer than 39 times. He estimated that she had been dead for about 3 hours and instructed that she be moved to the mortuary, which belonged to the workhouse at the old Montague Street.
Dr. Killeen was then able to carry out a proper post-mortem examination of the victim, the findings of which he presented to the inquest held on the 9th of August.
So just 2 days later?
Yeah. The following are extracts from his testimony describing the extent of the wounds. The left lung was penetrated in 5 places and the right lung in 2 places, but the lungs were otherwise perfectly healthy. The heart was rather fatty and was penetrated in 1 place, but there was otherwise nothing in the heart to cause death, although there was some bleeding in the pericardium. The liver was healthy but was penetrated in 5 places. The spleen was perfectly healthy and was penetrated in 2 places. Both of the kidneys were perfectly healthy and the stomach was also perfectly healthy but was penetrated in 6 places. The intestines were healthy and so were all the other organs. The lower portion of the body was penetrated in 1 place, the wound being 3 inches in length and 1 inch in depth. There was a deal of blood between the legs which were separated. The official cause of death was given by Killeen as hemorrhage and loss of blood. Unlike PC Barrett, however, Killeen didn't believe any sexual act had taken place immediately prior to the death, but he did note some oddities in the wounds.
So, this woman was completely healthy, except for all of the stab wounds.
Yeah, all of her organs, basically. Aside from a little bit of excess fat around the heart, but if she was plump, that's to kind of be expected. Yeah, aside from that, all of her organs were otherwise relatively healthy, like taking in like diet, alcohol, etc. for the area. Mm-hmm. She was otherwise fine. She was just stabbed a lot.
Yeah, do you think he said that the cause of death was hemorrhage because he couldn't pinpoint exactly which stab wound it was that killed her? Because normally we'd say, like, died by stab wound to the chest.
Yeah.
Died stab wound to the abdomen.
Yeah.
So I mean, instead of that, he just said that she died because all of the stab wounds.
Yeah, because he was quite careful to note that the stab wound to the heart hadn't been the death wound, hadn't been the fatal wound. Although there was some blood leakage inside the heart, which is to be expected if you stab the heart. So, yeah, it was just loss of blood.
Yeah. But you said there were some oddities found in the wounds.
Yes.
There was no sign of a struggle. One of the wounds had been made using the left hand, the rest using the right. He also deduced that 2 different weapons had been used. A smaller knife, such as like a pocket knife, was responsible for the majority of them, but a longer knife, similar to like a bayonet knife or a dagger, was responsible for a long wound against the breastbone.
So normally you would expect one distinct hand, so like you're left-handed or you're right-handed, you would expect one distinct hand.
Yeah.
It's very rare to find an ambidextrous person, but an ambidextrous killer is even rarer,
mm-hmm.
just because of the focus it takes. But also, 2 hands, 2 distinct different blades as well.
Yeah.
So the one blade was like the repeated stabbed one, and then the one is like the vicious abdomen, deep cut one.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Nice.
Inspector Edmund Reed of the Metropolitan Police's H Division that covered Whitechapel was put onto the case and straight away he faced challenges. I would just say at this juncture, both Em and I are big fans of the TV series Ripper Street,
mm-hmm.
and the main character played wonderfully by Matthew McFadden is Inspector Edmund Reed. And neither of us had any idea at that point that he was actually based on a real person.
Nope.
So I kind of did a double take when I read that.
Yeah, and they were the H Division in Whitechapel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was very... You realise just how much...
Yeah, it was... I mean, obviously, there was a lot of artistic licence, but there was a lot of historical accuracy there.
Yeah.
And if you do get a chance, watch it.
I want to rewatch it now we know that.
Yeah, definitely. Just see what else we can pick up on. Anyway, Inspector Reed, he was put onto the case, and straight away he faced challenges. The main one being that nobody at the George Yard buildings knew the victim. There were no clear clues, and as we pointed out by carefully saying each time, an undisturbed night's sleep... Nobody in the vicinity had heard anything on the night of the murder, even though the lack of a blood trail nearby would indicate that she was killed where she fell.
The press, as they do, had a field day and the public lapped it up. People would go to the George Yard buildings just to get a glimpse of where the body was found. Articles went out in papers describing the butchery and the savagery of the attack, and the locals became anxious. The St. Jude's Vigilance Committee was set up from a group of concerned local men who took it upon themselves to patrol the streets between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. to keep an eye out and to protect the locals from the vicious unknown killer. But the press coverage didn't much help with the inquest.
Yeah, there was a lot of either inaccurate reports or sensationalising.
That shocks me about the media.
Yeah. Considering, you know, we're in the middle of a petrol panic buying crisis.
Oh,
and,
don't.
Yeah. It's like there's a couple of places that are without petrol, but now thanks to the panic buying, because like stoked by the media, everywhere is out of petrol.
No petrol anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, back to 1888.
Mm-hmm.
Residents appeared and gave evidence at the inquest, but still nobody had heard anything. One tenant, a Mrs. Hewitt, said that she may have heard a cry of murder in the night, but this was such a common occurrence in Whitechapel, she ignored it and went to bed.
That's sad.
There are no words. One by one, the people mentioned above were called, but nothing sensational or even really helpful came from their testimonies. Three women came to the mortuary and each claimed to be able to name the victim, but they each gave a different name.
Helpful.
So they had no motive, no suspect, and the victim was still unknown. There were so many uncertainties that the coroner overseeing the case, George Collier, called for it to be adjourned for 2 weeks to enable more evidence to be gathered.
And eventually, on Monday the 13th of August in 1888, the first victim was finally named. Mr. Henry Tabram of East Greenwich had seen a proposed name of a victim printed in the paper and his heart sank. Though separated for 13 years by that point, Henry Tabram successfully identified the body as that of his estranged wife, Martha Tabram, and so the first victim of Jack the Ripper was known.
Martha was middle-aged at the time of her murder, having been born in Southwark in 1849. About 5'3", tall with dark hair, she married Henry Tabram in December 1869. They had two sons, Frederick and Charles, but due to Martha's heavy drinking, the marriage broke down, and they separated in 1875. Initially, he paid her an allowance of 12 shillings a week, but he reduced that to 2 shillings and sixpence when he found out she was living with another man. Fair enough, she didn't need him to support her anymore. She lived on and off with Henry Turner in the weeks leading up to her death, so a different Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a problematic relationship because of Martha's heavy drinking. It wasn't helped by the fact that the 4 shillings you needed for a doss house would also buy you a pint of gin at the local. She was known as Martha Turner, or sometimes as Martha White, during her time as a prostitute, and she was desperate for money after she had turned and separated. She was without a roof over her head, so she turned back to the streets.
Oh, bless her.
That was basically why she was on the streets and why she fell victim, potentially, to Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, and why she was like working as a prostitute.
Yeah.
So, the second murder. On Friday, the 31st of August in 1888, Polly Nichols was working the street, trying to find money for that night's accommodation. She had already been turned away from one lodging house, but had told the deputy there to save a room for her because she would be back. She had recently treated herself to a pretty black straw bonnet, trimmed with black velvet, and she was hoping this jolly bonnet would help her to draw in the customers.
She managed to make some money, and she managed to drink away that same money. So she was quite drunk when she ran into a friend of hers on the corner of Whitechapel Road and Osborne Street. The name of that friend does differ depending on your sources. Some call her Emily Holland, others call her Ellen Holland. They talked for a number of minutes where Holland tried to persuade her friend to go home with her, but Nichols wouldn't hear of it. "I've had my lodging money 3 times today," she said, "and I have spent it. It won't be long before I'll be back." Holland knew it was a lost cause, so she bid her friend farewell, not knowing that she would never see her alive again.
Mary Ann Polly Nichols was born Mary Ann Walker in August in 1845 in Soho in London. At 18, she married William Nichols at St. Bride's Parish Church, and they'd had 5 children together. Their marriage broke down due to Polly's drinking habits, and William left in 1880, taking all of the children with him. It was at this point that Polly turned to prostitution to survive, earning herself an extensive police record for it, as well as public drunkenness and disorderly conduct. She moved from workhouse to workhouse and even moved back in with her father for a short time before they quarrelled and she left, which is how she found herself back on the streets in 1888. Sorry, I needed to move. My leg was going dead.
Okay. At around 3:40 a.m. on the 31st of August 1888, Charles Cross was walking down Bucks Row, Whitechapel, on his way to work, heading down the north side of the street towards Baker's Row. As he approached a part of the road where it widened, he spotted something lying on the ground on the opposite end of the street. At first he just assumed it was a bit of tarpaulin, but as he walked closer to it, he realised it was in fact the body of a woman. Cross didn't really know what to do with his discovery, but he wasn't alone for long. From the other end of the street came Robert Paul, also on his way to work. Cross approached him and asked him to come and look at what he had found.
Cross touched the woman's cold hands and just assumed that she was dead, but Paul was a bit more thorough. He couldn't feel any breath, but could feel a slight movement in the woman's chest. He considered propping her up, but Cross refused to help. They decided that getting to work was more important, and they were both unable to see in the early morning gloom just how bad the injuries on this poor woman were. All they knew was that if they hung around any longer, they would be late, or worse, they could be implicated. So Cross and Paul tried to arrange the woman's skirt in a more dignified fashion, and then they went on their separate ways. So they came across this woman, almost dead, and left her because they didn't want to be late for work.
Yeah. Although, I mean, that does sound awful. However, at the same time, jobs weren't that easy to come by. And if you were late, you could lose your job, and that was it. You'd be out on the street.
Mm.
So, yes, probably have a bit more humanity, but
if they thought there was no saving her.
Yeah. Or they probably thought she was, like, hands and feet were cold, and they probably thought she was dead. So either she was beyond saving, or she just needed to sleep off a drunken night.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't quite leave her alone, though. As two men reached Baker's Row, they came across a PC Mizzen doing his rounds, and they told him what they'd seen, and they suspected her to be dead. Meanwhile, another policeman had already stumbled across the body.
Also kind of tried to help, and still got to work.
Yeah. PC John Neal was walking around his beat again that took him across the top of Books Row, having seen nothing suspicious on his round before. This time, however, he saw the body. He used his lamp to examine how she was laying, her eyes open and staring blankly out, one hand raised and touching the great gate, the other at her side. Next to her lay a small black bonnet with a black velvet trim.
Aww. PC Neal heard footsteps and saw a colleague, PC John Thane, approaching on his beat. PC Neal flagged him down and asked him to run and fetch a nearby doctor called Dr. Llewellyn.
As PC Mizzen rounded the corner and came upon the scene, PC Neal was feeling the woman's upper arm by her elbow and found it to still be warm. He instructed Mizzen to get an ambulance and then go get help from the nearby police station at Bethnal Green. Whilst he was waiting, PC Neal looked around for clues or potential witnesses.
He rang the bell on the main door of Essex Wharf and spoke to the manager, Walter Perkis, from an upper window who said that he had heard nothing. Soon, Sergeant Kirby appeared to help PC Neal and Kirby and went to the house next door to where the body still lay and spoke to the occupant of the property, Mrs. Green of New Cottage, and she confirmed that she too hadn't heard anything. Meanwhile, PC Neal used his lantern to scout around for physical clues, but he found nothing.
So no clues, no witnesses, absolutely silent, exactly the same as Martha Tabram.
Mm-hmm.
Around 4 a.m, Dr. Rhys Llewellyn of 152 Whitechapel Road attended the scene to make a preliminary examination of the body and officially pronounce death. Her hands were cold, but other parts of her were still warm, so Dr. Llewellyn concluded that she couldn't have been dead for more than half an hour. As locals were starting to hover around, the doctor asked for the body to be moved to a mortuary so he could continue his examination in peace and give her some dignity. He did notice, however, that there was very little blood considering the wounds he could see. A lot did appear to have been absorbed by her clothes. And it was reported that as they got her into the ambulance, there was quite a lot from touching her clothes that went onto the policeman's hands.
Inspector John Spratling accompanied the body in an ambulance to the mortuary on Old Montague Street and took down a description of the body whilst waiting for the morgue keeper to arrive and open up. The keeper, Robert Mann, arrived by about 5:20 and the body was moved inside where Spratling continued to take his description. He then lifted her clothes and discovered what had been done to her, meaning that Dr. Llewellyn was once again called.
Sadly, Dr. Llewellyn's original report hasn't survived time, but records of police reports have, so we have a rough idea of the injuries noted. So here's a quote from the report that Inspector Spratling made, though bear in mind his report was made prior to a full post-mortem being carried out. Her throat had been cut from left to right, two distinct cuts being on the left side, the windpipe, gullet and spinal cord being cut through, a bruise apparently of a thumb being on the right lower jaw, also one on left cheek. The abdomen had been cut open from the centre of bottom ribs along the right side, under pelvis to the left of the stomach. There the wound was jagged. The coating of the stomach was also cut in several places and two small stabs on the private parts, all apparently done with a strong bladed knife, supposed to have been done by some left-handed person, death being almost instantaneous.
I guess that's something. The idea of the wounds having been caused by a left-handed person was later brought into doubt by Dr. Llewellyn himself, as he second-guessed himself. He carried out the full post-mortem on the 1st of September in 1888 and presented his findings to the inquest. It was found that there were two incisions on the throat, the first being about 4 inches long from ear to about an inch below the jaw. The second was 8 inches long and more or less ran the entirety of her throat, severing both carotid arteries and all the tissue down to the spine.
Jesus.
Yeah. All of the wounds, even the jagged one, looked to have been carried out by the same weapon and could have been by a left-handed person, but also maybe not. So there still isn't a lot to go on about the murderer. Dr. Llewellyn estimated that the attack itself could have been carried out in around just 5 minutes. Such was the brutality and efficiency of it.
Yeah, so this was quick, it was brutal, it was over, which is probably why they didn't hear anything. She wouldn't have had time to scream if her throat was cut that quickly.
Mm-hmm. And that deep.
It was difficult to identify the woman. There were a few belongings on her person, but they didn't really give much of a clue as to who she was, and neither did her clothing. Well, not at first. Several women came forward to try and identify the body, including one Ellen/Emily Holland, who named her as Polly, someone she had once shared a room with at a lodging house on Thrall Street. It wasn't until taking a further look at the woman's clothing that a marker for Lambeth Workhouse was found on the petticoats, where the police were able to get a sure identity. Mary Ann Monk, an inmate of that workhouse, arrived at Old Montague Street on the 31st of August and identified the deceased as Mary Ann Nichols. The police were then able to trace her father, Edward Walker, and husband, William Nichols, who both arrived the next day and positively identified the body.
There was so much media coverage and local outrage around this crime, and the fact that the police seemed unable to give any indication of whether or not they had a suspect, that when it finally came the time for poor Polly Nichols to be buried, there was quite a crowd gathering for her funeral. In order to give her some sort of dignity, the hearse took a detour that would prove coincidental at best, prophetic at worst. The horse-drawn hearse travelled along Hanbury Street, but instead of turning into Old Montague Street for the mortuary, it carried on into Whitechapel Road and then doubled back, entering the mortuary by the back gate at Chapham's Court. Remember two of those names, Hanbury Street and Chapham's Court.
On the 6th of September 1888, Mary Ann Polly Nichols was laid to rest at the City of London Cemetery in Ilford.
This was now the third murder of an East End prostitute in relatively quick succession, though only Polly was from the Canonical Five. So Scotland Yard got involved, sending Inspector Frank Abberline to assist Inspector Edmund Reed in his investigations. Not that it did the police much good, as the killer left very little trace. Mass door-to-door investigations were carried out, and the police became a more visible presence on the streets. But still, nobody heard or saw anything out of the ordinary for the East End, and all the police could do was try. But Jack was only getting warmed up.
Now the third murder. September the 8th, 1888. John Richardson was heading to work. He decided to stop off at a tenement building at 29 Hanbury Street, where his mother lived. The front and back doors were unlocked, so he went out to the back to check on the security of the cellar door, where Mrs. Richardson kept her packing case workshop. He then sat on the stairs leading to the back door and used a knife to cut some excess leather from his boots, chilled for a few minutes, and then left again, shutting the front door behind him. This was around 4:50 a.m. and he saw nothing out of the ordinary.
At 5:45, John Davis, who was a resident of number 29 Hanbury Street, went down into the backyard. He noticed that the door to the street was wide open, which wasn't an odd thing, and the back door was closed. He opened the backyard and looked out from the top of the steps. There he saw a woman, lying on her back next to the fence between numbers 29 and 27, her skirt raised to just below her hips. He ran back and out into the street, where he came across James Green and James Kent, who worked for a neighbour, and Henry Holland on his way to work. Davis summoned them over to see what he had found. They walked up, but none of them could bring themselves to touch the body. They then left to find a police officer and something with which to cover the body as the sun was starting to rise.
Inspector Joseph Chandler arrived and took charge of the crime scene, attempting to disperse the milling onlookers. He sent for a physician, and Dr. George Phillips, the divisional police surgeon, arrived at around 6:30 a.m. He gave a full description of the body, and this is his description. I found the body of the deceased lying in the yard on her back, on the left hand of the steps that lead from the passage. The head was about 6 inches in front of the front level of the bottom step, and the feet were towards a shed at the end of the yard. The left arm was across the left breast, and the legs were drawn up, the feet resting on the ground and the knees turned outwards. The face was swollen and turned on the right side, and the tongue protruded between the front teeth, but not beyond the lips. It was much swollen. The small intestines and other portions were lying on the right side of the body on the ground above the right shoulder, but still attached. There was a large quantity of blood with a part of the stomach above the left shoulder. The body was cold, except that there was a certain remaining heat under the intestines in the body. Stiffness of the limbs was not marked, but it was commencing. The throat was dissevered deeply. I noticed that the incision of the skin was jagged and reached right around the neck.
Cool. That's unpleasant. Dr. Phillips estimated the time of death at about 2 hours prior, maybe longer, and had the body moved into the Whitechapel mortuary. He and Inspector Chandler then made a thorough search of the surrounding yard. There were some spots of blood on the back wall of the house near where the head had been laid, but no obvious signs of a struggle. It looked as though the murder had occurred in the yard. There were a couple of items that seemed to belong to the victim that had been arranged neatly close to where her feet had lain. A comb, a piece of muslin, and a second comb in a small paper case. Near where the head had lain was a torn piece of an envelope containing 2 pills with the words Sussex Regiment on and handwriting of partial words.
Inspector Chandler then went to the mortuary to write up a description of the body to provide the press for help with identification, whilst Dr. Phillips carried out the post-mortem, the report of which sadly no longer exists. He provided evidence to an inquest on the 13th and 19th of September, but the report of this no longer exists either. There is some evidence from the press, but for the sake of public decency, they omitted information about the worst of the injuries, so we'll never fully know what was found in detail.
No, but I don't know, do we need to know everything? What happened to this poor lady?
Probably, well, you and I probably don't, but you're more in-depth ripperologists, as they call themselves, or anyone doing a modern examination of the original evidence, would have helped them.
Yeah. What we do know is that there were bruises found around the right temple and on the top of the chest that looked about the size of a man's thumb, but they didn't seem to be recent. There were scratches along the face, showing that the face had been held before the throat was cut. Ring marks were evident on the fingers, showing that rings had been pulled from them, but these rings were never found. The throat had been cut, left to right, and then right to left, so deeply that they went into the spine, almost as though the killer had tried to sever her head completely. The protruding tongue appeared to be through death and occurred The protruding tongue appeared as though death had occurred partially through suffocation.
So she'd been seized, like her head had been held, she'd been suffocated, and then she'd been cut.
Yeah.
The abdomen was completely cut open, and the intestines lifted out and placed over the shoulder of the body, whilst the uterus and attachments, the upper portion of the vagina, and most of the bladder had been removed.
That's hardcore.
The incisions were clean, and the removed organs were never found. Trophies had been taken this time. Whilst the cuts to the throat had been jagged, the other wounds were clean and precise, which led to the suspicion that the killer had some anatomical knowledge. Dr. Phillips theorised that the wounds had been made with the same weapon and estimated it to be a blade about 6 to 8 inches long and lethally sharp, similar to like your bayonet blade and your dagger for the Tabram murder. The entire attack appears to have taken place within a quarter of an hour.
Jesus, he was fast.
Yeah.
Once again, witnesses were canvassed in the local area and nobody appeared to have heard anything. John Richardson recounted his movements that night and was adamant that he saw nobody in the yard. A second witness called Mrs. Elizabeth Long was called, having gone down Hanbury Street that morning on her way to Spitalfields Market at around 5:30 a.m. She recalled seeing a man and a woman standing and talking on the pavement near 29 Hanbury Street. She didn't see the man's face, but recalled him wearing a brown deerstalker hat and possibly wearing a dark coat. She estimated him to be over 40 years old and described him as shabby genteel. Mrs. Long recalled hearing the man asking, "Will you?" and the woman answering, "Yes," but didn't give much more than that.
The final witness was Albert Cadosh, who lived at 27 Hanbury Street. He went into the backyard of his building at around 5:20 in the morning and heard voices coming from the other side of the fence inside the backyard of number 29. He heard someone say no, and then he went back inside. A few moments later, he came back out again and heard something heavy fall against the fence, but then he left for work.
Inspector Abeline agreed with Dr. Phillips that the victim had been killed where she had been found, but when was proving to be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Phillips assessed that time of death was around 4:30 a.m. However, John Richardson had been in the yard at about 4:50 and was adamant that nobody was there. Inspector Chandler began to think that Richardson had overlooked the body.
Yeah, so you got the doctor saying, well, it clearly was there and you didn't see it. And Richardson going, it clearly wasn't there because I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. So this back and forth. Once the description of the body and her clothing were released to the press, family came forward and identified the victim. Now, do you recall what we said, remember, about the streets? Hanbury Street and Chapman's Court?
Mm-hmm.
The victim found at number 29 Hanbury Street was identified as Dark Annie Chapman.
That's weird.
Yep.
That's spooky. In like, a bad way.
Yeah.
Obviously, but...
That's an odd coincidence.
Mm-hmm. Annie Chapman was the oldest of five children, born as Eliza Ann Smith in Paddington in 1840. In 1869, she married John Chapman, and together they had three children, though their daughter, Emily, great name, died young from meningitis. Not so great. Once again, drink drove the family apart, and the couple separated in 1884. Their son had gone into care due to an advanced disability, so John Chapman kept custody of their daughter, and Annie moved to London, where her husband paid her a weekly allowance of 10 shillings. John Chapman later died in December in 1886, on Christmas Day, no less. And so the payment ceased, and Annie was forced to find other ways to earn her money, including prostitution, which ultimately led to her death. So, the double event. What's worse than a murder?
Two in one night.
That's exactly what happened on the 29th and to the 30th of September, 1888.
A social club called the International Working Men's Educational Club met regularly at number 40 Berner Street, and this was one such night. In the early hours of the 30th of September, 1888, Joseph Lane used a side entrance to the club, which is on Duffield's Yard, and saw nothing out of the ordinary. A few minutes later, he was followed in by Maurice Eagle, who also saw nothing out of the ordinary.
20 minutes later, at 1 a.m, the steward of the club, Lewis Demschutz, arrived on his carriage and pulled into Duffield's Yard. The pony veered to the left and refused to go forward any further. Demschutz got down from his carriage, thinking he saw the outline of something in the gloom. He leaned forward and struck a match, and in the dim light he saw the body of a woman. Fearing it could be his wife, who regularly drank at the social club, he ran inside. He spotted her within and then realised that this was someone else, so he alerted the members and they went to find the police.
The officer they found was PC Henry Lamb, and he accompanied them back to Duffield's Yard, where he saw the body and sent a second, unnamed constable who was with him, to get the doctor. Dr. Frederick Blackwell of 100 Commercial Road attended with his assistant, Edward Johnston. They found the body, with the exception of the hands, to be warm, but the blood coming from the woman's neck had now started to congeal and the wound itself had stopped bleeding. So here's a quick description from Dr. Blackwell when he arrived on the scene. So this is about 1:16 a.m. and this is the initial investigation that he made in the light of the policeman's lantern. The deceased was lying on her left side obliquely across the passage, her face looking towards the right wall. Her legs were drawn up, her feet close against the wall of the right side of the passage. Her head was resting beyond the carriage wheel rut, the neck lying over the rut. Her feet were 3 yards from the gateway. Her dress was unfastened at the neck. The neck and chest were quite warm, as were also the legs, and the face was slightly warm. The hands were cold. The right hand was open and on the chest and was smeared with blood. The left hand, lying on the ground, was partially closed and contained a small packet of cachous wrapped in tissue paper. There were no rings nor marks of rings on her hands. The appearance of the face was quite placid. The mouth was slightly open. The deceased had around her neck a check silk scarf, the bow of which was turned to the left and pulled very tight. In the neck there was a long incision which exactly corresponded with the lower border of the scarf. The border was slightly frayed as if by a sharp knife. The incision on the neck commenced on the left side, 2.5 inches below the angle of the jaw, and almost in a direct line with it, nearly severing the vessels on that side, cutting the windpipe completely in two and terminating on the opposite side, 1.5 inches below the angle of the right jaw, but without severing the vessels on that side. I could not ascertain whether the bloody hand had been moved. The blood was running down the gutter into the drain on the opposite direction from the feet. There was about 1 pound of clotted blood close by the body, and a stream all the way down there to the back door of the club. Her clothes weren't disturbed, though. Despite all that, her clothes were not disturbed. Aside from the flow of blood from the neck, there were no other obvious traces of blood, and Dr. Blackwell placed time of death at around 12:56 a.m.
Quite specific, that.
This means that it's very likely that, had Dean Schutz raised his match a little higher that morning, he may have seen it reflected in the eyes of Jack the Ripper.
What?
He came that close.
Jeez. So, the Ripper was disturbed that night, but he wasn't done. 3/4 of a mile from Duckfield Yards stands Mitre Square, mostly made up of business premises, so virtually deserted after dark. This lay on the beat of PC Edward Watkins, who would walk up and down to around a 15-minute route around the block, circling through Mitre Square. At about 1:30 a.m, he had passed through the square and seen nothing of note. As his route took him through again at about 1:45 a.m, he turned to the right and saw the body of a woman laying on her back with her feet facing the square and her clothes above her waist. He could see in his lamplight that her throat had been cut and her clothes were above her waist. The following is his description of the sight.
I came round to Mitre Square again at 1:45, and entering the square from Mitre Street on the right-hand side, I turned sharp round to the right, and flashing my light, I saw the body in front of me. The clothes were pushed right up to her breast, and the stomach was laid bare, with a dreadful gash from the pit of the stomach to the breast. On examining the body, I found the entrails cut out and laid around the throat, which had an awful gash in it, extending from ear to ear. In fact, the head was nearly severed from the body. Blood was everywhere to be seen. It was difficult to discern the injuries of the face for the quantity of blood which covered it. The murderer had inserted the knife just under the left eye and, drawing it under the nose, cut the nose completely from the face, at the same time inflicting a dreadful gash down the right cheek to the angle of the jawbone. The nose was laid over on the cheek. A more dreadful sight I never saw. It quite knocked me over.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Yeah.
Watkins went into the nearby building of Kirley and Tongs to find George Morris sweeping stairs inside. He called for his help and set him to guard the body whilst Watkins ran out with his whistle blowing to attract other police. PC James Harvey and PC James Holland came to his aid.
Inspector Collard at Bishopgate Street Station got the news at 1:55 a.m. and sent a constable to get Dr. George Sequeira of 34 Jewry Street to attend the scene. Shortly after, they were joined by Dr. Frederick Brown at around 2:18 a.m, and it's because of his report that we have the most information about the scene. He then gave instructions for the body to be moved to the City Mortuary in Golden Lane. This is where the crossover between police forces comes into play. Until now, the murders were in the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Police, but now it had crossed that line into that of the City of London Police. So their own commissioner, Sir James Fraser, would have been notified. However, he was on leave at the time, and it was instead dealt with by Acting Commissioner Major Henry Smith and Inspector James McWilliam.
Once again, witnesses in the local area were consulted, and once again, nobody had heard any noise. So the search began for clues. At 2:55 a.m, PC Alfred Long of the Metropolitan Police discovered a bloodied bit of a woman's apron on Golston Street outside the entrance to 108 to 119 Wentworth Model Dwellings. He looked around for any more blood or a body, but there was nothing. That was when he lifted his lantern to the wall.
Written in chalk on the brickwork was the following: "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." Oddly, Long didn't ask around the locals to see if anyone had seen or heard anything. He picked up the piece of apron and took it to the Commercial Street Police Station. Soon enough, officers from both police departments converged on the site where the writing was. Inspector McWilliam instructed that the message should be photographed, whilst the officers did a search of the local tenements for witnesses or suspects. However, no photographs were taken, because Commissioner Sir Charles Warren of the Metropolitan Police ordered the chalk writing to be wiped away. It has since been supposed that it was at the suggestion of Superintendent Thomas Arnold of H Division, Nobody is completely sure why this was done, but the prevailing theory is that there was already a lot of anti-Semitic sentiment in the area, and that this message, evidence though it was, would potentially inflame that into vigilante violence, which is the last thing the police needed. It should, however, have been photographed at least.
Yeah, definitely.
There is also a lot of speculation as to why the word Jews was spelt J-U-W-E-S and not J-E-W-S. But we would recommend you read up around that yourself and formulate your own opinion. There's some links to like how it was spelt in the diary, in the Bible, and lots of like different reasons why.
Yeah. Inspector Edmund Reed had the job of identifying the Dutfield Road victim, and so he examined the body at St. George's Mortuary. He couldn't find anything that would easily identify the woman on her person, so he took as detailed a description of her as he possibly could, going on as far as to open her mouth and observe some of the teeth were missing. His description was then released to the press and was met with a barrage of potential identifications.
One person who practically bombarded the police with insistence that she knew the victim was a Mrs. Mary Malcolm, who insisted that the body was that of her sister, Mrs. Elizabeth Watts. She positively identified the body on a trip to the mortuary, saying that there was a black mark on the victim's leg, and that was due to an adder bite that her sister had when they were younger. She was understandably very distressed by what was happening, right up to the point where her actual sister, now Mrs. Elizabeth Stokes, turned up alive and mostly well.
So it wasn't her then?
No, it wasn't her.
Among all that, however, a genuine positive identification was made of an Elizabeth Stride, a Swedish national who had migrated to England and ended up working on the streets. Nobody really knew a lot about her. There was a record of a marriage at a Swedish church in Princes Square to a Mr. John Stride, which was listed her name as Elizabeth
Gustav's daughter.
Who was daughter of Augustus...
Augustus Gustafsson.
Thank you.
I mean, nice try.
You said there wasn't any hard words in this.
I completely forgot, I'm sorry.
It's so horrible.
Not bad. We didn't know much about her really, just that her marriage eventually broke down, and while she had randomly told people that her husband had drowned aboard the Princess Alice, which is a ship, apparently she had quite an active imagination, this was not the case. She spent time in the Poplar Workhouse and then spent time in the Whitechapel Infirmary due to bronchitis. After being discharged, she went right back onto into the workhouse and then spent time in and out of the lodge house at Flower and Dean Street. We know her husband didn't die on the Prince Alice because he later died in October 1884 of heart disease.
Elizabeth then lived as a widow for some 3 years with Michael Kidney at 35 Devonshire Street, near to where he worked. During her time at Flower and Dean Street, Elizabeth earned the nickname Long Liz and seemed to have been well liked in the area, although she was known to the Thames Magistrate Court due to drunken and disorderly behaviour. She had no surviving children, having had a stillborn daughter in 1865.
There's a theme appearing with these women, aren't there? Broken down marriages and drunken disorderly behaviour. There were a few people around prior to her death, although there was nothing concrete. She was allegedly seen with a relatively well-dressed man between 11 to 11:45pm on the 29th of September. Then at 2:35am, she was seen again with a man who was holding a parcel wrapped in newspaper by PC William Smith.
On his way through Dutfield Yard heading to work, Israel Schwartz saw a man throwing a woman to the ground at about 12:45am. Nearby was another man smoking a pipe. The man who had thrown the woman down shouted Lipinski as he passed, which was a common Jewish slur at the time. And Schwartz walked on faster, but the pipe smoker started to follow him. Lipinski could have been the name of the pipe smoker, and this was a signal for him to follow Schwartz, but it was often used as a slur due to known Jewish murderer Israel Lipinski.
Yeah, so basically this Israel Lipinski was a known Jewish murderer, so as an insult, people would shout Lipinski at any Jewish person. There's no excuse for it, basically.
That also makes no sense.
Yeah, it's like, you all look like murderers to me. Okay, cool. Thanks. I mean, you don't really know what to say to that.
Nope.
It was easier to identify the second victim, despite the extent of her mutilations. A detailed description was once again taken and released, including mention of a tattoo with the initials TC on her left forearm. There were a couple of pawn tickets in the pocket that helped to trace recent activity. She was identified by a Mr. John Kelly at the Bishopgate Street station as Katie Conway, or Katie Kelly, a woman who had been living with him for 7 years at 55 Flower and Dean Street. So I think it was the tattoo that gave it away.
Yeah. It was later found that her real name was Catherine Eddowes, one of 11 children. Kate met Thomas Conway when she was aged 16 whilst living in Birmingham, and they lived together. Not much is known about Conway except that he was regularly abusive to Kate. Together they had 3 children, but eventually separated after moving back to London in about 1880-1881. It was then, in 1881, that Kate met John Kelly and started to live with him at Flower and Dean Street.
So that's how she got to the area.
Yeah.
The final murder. At this point, the murderer was known as Leather Apron or the Whitechapel Murderer, but now a real name appeared. A letter was sent on the 27th of September 1888 to the Central News Agency, written in red ink and signed Jack the Ripper. This has become known as the Dear Boss Letter, and I actually have an example of the Dear Boss Letter here. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
25th of September 1888. Dear Boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about Leather Apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores, and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it then went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. Ha ha. If I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly, wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Don't mind me giving the trade name. Wasn't good enough to post this before. I got all the red ink off my hands. Curse it. No luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now. Ha ha. That was a Dear Boss letter.
That's unnerving.
Yeah. A second letter was then sent. I wasn't coddling dear old boss when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow. Double event this time. Number one squealed a bit. Couldn't finish straight off. Had not time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper. It mentioned the double event, dated the 1st of October. The police then scrambled to try and find the source of the letters. They had like handwriting analysis and everything, but they couldn't.
Then a parcel arrived at the address of George Lusk, chairman of the Mile End Vigilance Committee. There was a letter attached, and inside the box was half of a human kidney. Examinations were carried out, and it was confirmed that the kidney had been harvested recently and was from a woman in her mid-40s and no stranger to drink, matching Kate Eddowes. The press and public latched on the name, and so Jack the Ripper was born. And where did he say he had written the letters? They were signed From Hell, and he had one last victim to take.
Have you ever heard the Mr. Lusk letter?
No.
It's disturbing. Sir, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you to the piece I tried and ate. I fried and ate. It was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out if you only wait a while longer. Catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk.
So he's also claiming to be a cannibal?
Apparently so, yeah.
Yeah.
Mary Jane Kelly. Mary Jane Kelly was an Irish prostitute who had lodgings on Dorset Street for a rent of 4 shillings 6 pence a week. 2 windows of the building looked out onto Miller's Court, so it was called Miller's Court, and 2 of the panes on one of the windows had been broken. It was fairly common for her to arrive back drunk singing Irish songs, and so she was known in the area.
Born in Limerick, the family moved to Wales whilst Mary Jane was still young. Aged 16, she married a collier named Davies, but he was killed in an explosion at the mine of a couple years later. In 1884, aged 21, she arrived in London and started work in a West End brothel. She stayed with a number of different men whilst working as a prostitute before ending up on Dorset Street.
She also apparently spent some time in France with one of them, and whilst it wasn't really a good time, she would sometimes, to give herself like that exotic lilt, would style herself Marie-Jeannette Kelly.
Hmm.
Yeah. She lived at number 13 Miller's Court off Dorset Street with a Joe Barnett until the 30th of October 1888, when an argument saw Barnett storming out. Mary had been forced to return to prostitution to help pay the rent whilst Barnett was away working, and she'd let a homeless prostitute share her lodgings, which Barnett was not happy about on his return. He moved out, but they did remain good friends.
He visited her on the 8th of November to apologise that he couldn't help financially support her that month and he had no work. It was the last time that he saw her alive.
At 10:45 on the 9th of November, John McCarthy, Mary's landlord, checked all his books, he was doing his accounts, and realised that she was 29 shillings in arrears. So he sent his shop assistant, Thomas Bowyer, round to number 13 to collect on the rent.
Bowyer knocked on the door, but there was no answer. He knocked again, and still nothing. So he went round to the broken window and pulled back the curtain. In a panic at what he saw, he ran back to fetch the landlord. McCarthy returned with him to the address and, ashen-faced at what he saw, commanded Bowyer to go and fetch the police. Inspector Walter Beck and Walter Drew from the Commercial Street station accompanied him, and McCarthy, who had run after Bowyer, unable to stand being there any longer alone. Back to the Miller's Court. They arrived shortly after 11 a.m. and both looked through the window to see something that they would never forget.
By 11:15, George Phillips had arrived, and shortly after, at 11:30, Inspector Abeline arrived. The door was locked and nobody thought to force entry until 1:30, as Dr. Phillips had ascertained through the window that she was beyond help, so no entrance needed to be made. Abeline was apparently waiting for the police dogs to be called, although they later found out that the police dogs weren't available that day. In the meantime, the general area was sealed off and statements taken from local residents, and a photographer took photos of the corpse through the window.
At 1:30, Superintendent Arnold arrived and gave the order for the door to be opened, which McCarthy did with a pickaxe, despite it being possible to reach in and spring the lock through the window.
Like, that entire time they could have literally just reached in and clicked it.
Yep. An extract from the notes of Dr. Thomas Bond, colleague of Dr. Phillips, shows what they found inside.
The body was lying naked in the middle of the bed, the shoulders flat, but the axis of the body inclined to the left side of the bed. The head was turned on the left cheek. The left arm was close to the body, with the forearm flexed at a right angle and lying across the abdomen. The right arm was slightly abducted from the body and rested on the mattress, the elbow bent and the forearm supine with the fingers clenched. The legs were wide apart, the left thigh at right angles to the trunk, and the right forming an obtuse angle with the pubis. The whole of the surface of the abdomen and thighs was removed, and the abdominal cavity emptied of its viscera. The breasts were cut off, the arms mutilated by several jagged wounds, and the face hacked beyond all recognition of the features, and the tissues of the neck were severed all round down to the bone. The viscera were found in various parts, vis-à-vis the uterus and kidneys, with one breast under the head, the other breast by the right foot, the liver between the feet, the intestines by the right side, and the spleen by the left side of the body. The flaps removed from the abdomen and thighs were on a bedside table. The bed clothing at the right corner was saturated with blood, and on the floor beneath was a pool of blood covering about 2 feet square. The wall by the right side of the bed, and in line with the neck, was marked with blood which had struck it in a number of separate splashes.
Jeez. Once the remains were moved, number 13 was boarded up and padlocked, and two constables were left to guard the property from eager and morbid civilians, though that didn't stop them milling around nearby.
Yeah, people would go and rubberneck, and there was actually, not here, more at Buck Street and down Hanbury Street as well, local residents would charge like a couple of pennies to go and have a look at the area where the body was.
That's so weird.
Witnesses weren't overly helpful, as they hadn't been previously. The best testimony was that of neighbour Mary Ann Cox, who had seen Mary Jane with a man heading towards Miller's Court at about 11:30 p.m. on the night before. Mary Jane was clearly drunk, and Mrs. Cox had called out goodnight to her. Mrs. Cox described the person she was with, though. About 36 years old, maybe, and maybe 5'5", with blotches on his face and small side whiskers, with a carroty moustache, dressed in shabby dark clothes and a black felt hat. She also noted that he carried a pot of ale in his hands. Later that night, she heard Mary Jane Kelly singing and then silence. She didn't hear anything else suspicious. Now, we know this is Mary Jane because of where she lived. However, Barnett did actually identify her, but because of the level of her mutilations, he was only able to identify her by the colour of her hair.
But the colour of hair is... loads of people have the same colour hair.
Yeah, but I think hers was, like, quite a recognisable red.
Ah, okay. Oh, yeah, she was Irish, wasn't she? So, yeah. One person, however, Elizabeth Prater, who lived in the room above Mary's, may have heard something. She returned home at 1:30 a.m. and fell asleep quickly, having been pretty drunk. She was then woken up a couple of hours later by her cat climbing on her, and she heard a cry of murder from outside. However, her evidence has been discounted due to a lot of discrepancies with the time, and she didn't react to the shouts because it was a common occurrence in the area.
The police investigation again led nowhere. The lack of evidence of the killer, the bungled way the investigation was handled, and the limited advances in the field of forensic investigation all worked together to hamper their work, which may be why Jack the Ripper was never caught. Or was he?
So, that is the timeline of the murders in 1888. Quite quick succession, really.
Yeah, it was within a couple of months.
Yeah. There was a number of suspects in the case, and Ripperologists all have complementing as well as contrasting theories for each. There are two that stand out to us, for different reasons. For me, I think it's some guy called Francis Tumblety.
Okay, why do you think it's Francis Tumblety?
Because there's just so many... Basically, I think it's because after these, he then moved to America.
Mm.
And then there were some murders that happened in America, the same way as they happened in England. But they haven't confirmed or denied whether these are connected.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think it's suspicious that this guy kind of went to America and then the killing stopped in England, but they were then in America.
Tumblety.
Yep.
Got some information about him for you.
Mm-hmm.
He was an American physician who was actually born in Ireland, and he's listed on Wikipedia as his occupation being a quack doctor. He advertised himself as an Indian herb doctor and he used to try and cure wounds by using all types of herbs. His record wasn't squeaky clean, however. He was arrested and accused of theft and assault. One of the things that's a little bit suspicious about him is that later, after this was all over, he held a dinner in Washington, and in his house it was found that he had jars containing wombs of every class of woman. He just had random jars of uteri. Uteri, uteruses? I don't know. However, in 1869 he came to London. He then went away again. He came back in 1888. Nobody knows whereabouts he was in 1888. They just know he was in London. He was arrested on November the 7th, which was before Mary Jane Kelly died, and he was arrested for inappropriate behaviour. However, that's not to say that he wasn't arrested and kept and then released.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been. He then fled back to America, and there are rumours about that dinner from a guy called Charles Dunham, and he was also a known perjurer and a pathological liar. However, he didn't match the description, but witness accounts can be dubious.
Yeah, the description was given by a drunk woman.
Here's some damning evidence. After Tumblety's death in the early 1900s, I think it's about 1903, his estate was divvied up, and as well as like the random uterus jars, there were found two rings.
It was him!
Could they have been Chapman's rings?
It was... Tumblety.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's who I think. How about you?
I think it was a guy... I mean, Tumblety is credible, mm-hmm. but I think it may have been a guy called Aaron Kosminski.
Okay.
So, serial killers... I'm no expert, but having been exposed through Mother to a lifetime of psychology and listening to serial killers and reading about them, they rarely just stop.
Yeah.
It's like a need. They don't just stop.
Mm-hmm.
So they're either captured, killed, or locked away somewhere, removed from the situation. That's why Tumblety works, because he went to America. But that's why Aaron Kosminski also works. Now, Kosminski was a madman, basically. Okay. He was described as Sir Robert Anderson, as a low-class Polish Jew in an asylum. Some unnamed witnesses said that they might have seen someone matching his description. So he matched the description quite closely. But these people didn't want to testify against him for some reason. There was a lot of anti-Semitic sentiment. They probably didn't want to implicate a Jewish person just in case that got worse.
Mm-hmm.
Anderson and McNaughton named this person's surname. So PC, Sir Anderson and a PC called McNaughton gave a surname of Kozminski. So they didn't want to testify. Nobody really said who this person was that they were testifying against. But they turned around and said, you know what? No, it's a Jewish guy called Kozminski.
I mean, that's not a very common surname.
No. However, McNaughton said that Kozminski was committed to an asylum in March 1889, and he died shortly afterwards. It slightly mismatches a little bit, because what we actually know is that he went to Colney Hatch Asylum in 1891, and he died in 1919. So, there were other potential victims, which we'll come to in a second, and if those other victims are taken to be Jack the Ripper's victims, him being committed in 1891 actually works.
Okay.
But there are a couple of other suspects.
Mm-hmm.
There is Joseph Barnett.
Yeah.
Kelly's partner. He possibly felt rejected by the breakup, but he says it was friendly. He doesn't actually have an alibi for what he was doing after midnight that night. And he did have a key to the room, and he knew how to open the room for number 13. He lost the key for a while, but then he found it again, and he said that the door locks itself automatically after you close it. You just reach in through the window and pop it open. So he knew how to get in, he knew how to close it, he knew where she was, when she was, he knew everything. Likely suspect. Doesn't have an alibi.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Cross, we mentioned his name in passing earlier, he was the one that found the body on Hanbury Street and decided to go on, carry on for work. He found Marianne Nichols, but he was interrupted by the chap, Paul. He was a car man living on 22 Doveton Street, and that was occupied by Charles Leshmere, not a Charles Cross. So we think he's given a false name.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Cross was actually Leshmere's stepfather's name, not his name. The walk to work coincides with work commute patterns, but there are some anomalies. And also, he may have come across Liz Stride and Catherine Eddowes when he was out visiting his mum. He worked for Pickford's, likely doing deliveries of meats around, or he said, that was what he said in his testimony, I work for Pickford's delivering meat. Pickford's had no record of him, either as a Charles Cross or a Charles Lechmere. So his story didn't add up.
Mm-mm.
Which is interesting. There's a guy called George Hutchinson, who we don't really know a whole deal about him, but we know he was interrogated by the police for some reason. And then there's Leather Apron. Another apron was John Pycer, and that was in a different part of London. There was some criminal profiling done by a guy called Thomas Bond, and said that he was respectfully dressed, but he didn't really have anatomical knowledge. He was of average height, mid-30s, late 20s at a push, medium to bulky build, familiar with the East End, possibly employed as like during the day so he could then go and murder on the evenings and weekends, and it's likely that he was interviewed by the police. So, those are the suspects.
Out of all of them, who was the only one who had anatomical knowledge? Who was a doctor or a quack?
Who was the one who was mad enough to be brutal and sadistic in his killings?
Yeah, but would he, if he was mad enough, would he have known at the Kozminski, would he have been able to cleanly cut the organs out and leave them over the shoulder and cut the nose off in such a way? And
depends on, because I honestly don't know a whole lot about Kozminski's early life, so he could have had some butcher training. Because butcher was quite a common job back then. So it's entirely possible. You never know. They're both as likely as each other.
Yeah.
If you think that any of those are the killer, or if you have your own idea of who Jack the Ripper was, then why don't you put something in the comments?
Yeah, let us know.
Yeah, state your case. Or if you're not sure, go and research them, have a look into them, and then make your mind up and let us know. Let's start a debate about this going, who we think
these
it was.
These sort of things do, like, get to me, because I hate history mysteries.
Yeah.
I know we're not meant to, but I like completion.
Yeah, that's why you like closure.
Yeah.
We'll never really know the truth, I don't think. No. And I think that is actually part of the fascination. Because without a suspect, we don't have a motive. We don't know why these women had to die. As well as the six that we referenced above, there are a couple of other women who are believed but not canonically confirmed to be victims of the Ripper. Those are Annie Millwood, who died on the 25th of February 1888, Ada Wilson on the 28th of March 1888, Rose Milet on the 20th of December 1888, Alice Mackenzie on the 17th of July 1889, and Frances Coles on the 13th of February 1891. please, if we can ask one thing of you, please look into all of these women, read about them, learn about them, and most of all, please remember them. Jack the Ripper is fascinating, and he's a great bogeyman in the public conscience. It's easy to distance ourselves from it, because it happened over 100 years ago. But these were real women, with hard lives and a lot of troubles, who did not remotely deserve the violent ends that they received. To die so scared and so alone like that, nobody deserves that.
No. But I guess the one thing we can take from the details of their death, it seems as if none of them suffered.
They died
very quickly.
Yeah.
All the sick, sadistic, brutal stuff was like done after.
Yeah, it was very quick. Although the thing that shocked me, and I had to message you about it when I was doing the research, was like, oh my God. We think that Jack the Ripper, 100 years ago, 1888, not in living memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and no, because Annie Chapman had two sons,
mm-hmm.
and the youngest of the sons died the same year your dad was born.
That's so weird.
So, the same year that your dad was alive, came into existence, your father, you can sit and talk to now, the same year that he was born, died the son of a Ripper victim.
That's crazy. That was only 1956.
Yeah. And whilst you get the likes of, like, Sweeney Todd, we're not entirely sure that was right, that was correct, you know, there's some historical basis, yeah. but Sweeney Todd didn't happen. This happened.
Yeah.
These are real people.
This definitely happened.
Yeah, this was a real person who decided to do this to real people.
But he got away with it.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so fascinating and so frustrating, because he got away with it. There's never been justice. And yes, there have been more prolific serial killers out there. There have been more brutal serial killers out there. But we know who they are. Mm. We know their motives. We know why. With Jack the Ripper, we don't know why.
No, that's the thing. Like, I believe in karma. So whoever he was, I don't think he had a pleasant rest of his life. Karma would have came around and got him hardcore. I believe that. And I think I have to believe that. Mm. To believe that if someone's going to do these horrible things and get away with it, it'll come back on him in another way.
There's always a comeuppance. But it's
the not knowing why, what was the point.
Yeah. So what, I mean, not that the why ever makes it better.
No.
What they did, but it's just like, okay, that's why. We can try and rationalise it through like childhood trauma, through personality disorders, through physical trauma relating to personality changes. We can try and do that. But we don't know why. We don't know why he hated that specific type of woman. We don't know why he decided to take the trophies. We don't know why he decided on those few to, like, line the intestines around the throat. Why?
I do not know, and it will bug me.
Yeah.
Forever.
But there is a lot of information out there on Jack the Ripper. There are people who have dedicated yeah. their entire lives to figuring it out, or to at least get as much information as possible. So there is no shortage of information out there. And there are also Ripper tours, and if you're unable to go on one of the Ripper tours, so for example you're not in England or you're not able to go out because they are walking tours, you can actually, there is a lovely channel on YouTube that does a virtual walking tour, so the person does the tour and you're walking around with them, but without leaving your home.
Mm.
Which is interesting. There's also hundreds of films, games, books, comics,
TV shows.
Yeah, there's Ripper Street. There's From Hell with Johnny Depp. Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah, it's interesting.
I guess a lot on him. Popular culture can be done that way because there is no conclusion. There's so much you can do with artistic license. Mm. You can create the motive. You can create your murderer.
But also, in a way, because there's that mystery, people are always going to feed into it. They're always going to be interested yeah. by it. So you've always got a money spinner.
Yeah.
But at the same time, because we don't know why, that makes it all the more frightening. So what's the best way to make something not as frightening? Entertain us with it.
Mm-hmm.
Make it entertaining so we're not as frightened. We can say, oh yeah, we saw From Hell. We saw it in like the Johnny Depp film. We know that it's like Surrey and Home. It wasn't. Like that theory was disputed. Yeah, we know it's this kind of person, we know this happened, so it doesn't make it as real, as scary anymore.
Yeah.
So we can sort of push it back, but it happened.
Yep.
I almost feel bad now going on to the next bit, which is the ridiculous death.
How about before that, we try and give some voices to other women.
because these women couldn't have a voice.
Exactly.
So, if you're interested in perseverance, human perseverance against the odds, have a listen to Culturally Speaking. And here's why.
Hey, do you want to hear about Scott who came back from the dead?
Or why Nelson wrote a book called Unlucky Sperm Club?
How about Terry, whose mother pretty much exchanged her for drugs?
Season 3 of Culturally Speaking is back, where we share amazing stories of life-changing experiences and adversities that truly celebrate human resilience.
Check out Culturally Speaking now on all podcast platforms, and remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen. You'll also find us on Instagram at Culturally Speaking Podcast.
Welcome back to A Dark Cup of Histity, and now we're going to do our characteristic ridiculous death. Now, this one isn't quite ridiculous, because the way that they died isn't ridiculous. It's the fact that the odds of it happening are ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this. Carrie found this one, and I honestly have no idea.
Well, there are a few incidences of this particular thing happening throughout time.
Right.
However, this is potentially the first reported example of this happening.
Okay.
Okay, so this is from researchers at the Meteorological Society. They found evidence of a meteorite that killed one man and left another paralysed after it fell like rain on a village in Sulaymaniyah in Iraq, formerly part of the Ottoman Empire, on August 22nd, 1888.
Oh, same year.
Yeah. And the way they found this, it was found in three manuscripts that were kept in the Turkish government archive, so it had to be translated from the original Ottoman language. It was reported to Abdulhamid II, who was the 34th Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, by the governor of Sulaymaniyah, and that prompted speculation that other incidents might have well happened and been recorded elsewhere. If true, it would mark the earliest and the only credible proof of a human being killed directly by a meteorite. So this isn't things like the meteorite hitting like a house and the house falling down, or hitting tree falling down, or causing a fire. This is meteorite on a person.
You mean like the way the dinosaurs were killed?
Theoretically, yes.
Jeez.
Or that fella from Pompeii.
Yeah.
The unluckiest man in the world.
Yep.
The reason this is ridiculous is because the chances that scientists believe of this happening is the odds of around 1 in 250,000.
Jeez.
So it's 1 in 250,000 chance. And this poor fella was standing outside looking at this meteor shower. One got a little bit too close and it was the last thing he saw as it hit him.
Oh.
And he died.
Christ.
Yeah.
Wow, I mean,
imagine being the person on the other side of the world who saw that, though, and made a wish on that falling star.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah, I know, I'm a terrible person.
Very.
But yeah.
But I mean, what a way to kickstart our dark month, Carrie, with a horrendously dark... Thank you.
The darkest serial killer that England has ever known. And we've known some doozies.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
But don't worry, next week we're leaving human and going into paranormal.
Ooh, this is exciting.
So, we'll speak with you then. But until then, take care.
Stay safe.
And we'll speak to you soon.
Bye.